Let's take another look at that unprovoked police brutality.
It's the 18th of November 2011, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a radio program and podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. On Frozen Planet, can only penguins hear you scream? Did Phobos Grunt fail because it didn't want to soil itself? Why should atheists care about the Bible? And if one lie is a tragedy, is a million lies politics? But first, if Tom Morello is a one-man revolution, does that make the Occupy protesters redundant? We start this week with the Occupy movement. It's all kicked off in America over the last few days, but what's it all about? What will it lead to? And what role does music play in protest these days? To find out, we spoke to one man who's perhaps occupied more places than most, Tom Morello, who you may know from Rage Against the Machine or his solo work as the Night Watchman. We somehow got an interview with Tom, hence why we've got a slightly rageified theme tune this week, remixed by the amazing Milton Mermakidis. The interview was recorded just before The Man started cracking down in Zuccotti Park, but just days after Tom had played live at Occupy London during the huge tuition fees protest on November the 9th. I started by asking him how it went.
Occupy London was, you know, in the same spirit as of the other Occupies I've visited in the UK, Canada, and in the United States, you know, it's a global community of the 99% who don't own and control the world, protesting the fact that the 1% who do own and control the world are doing so in the name of power, profit, and privilege at the expense of human rights and environmental sanity. My performance, I arrived late because I had a big day of doing interviews with nice people like you, and they had actually shut down the stage, so I performed in a very guerrilla style in the Occupy kitchen after it was dark with police helicopters overhead, but it felt like it was very much the spirit of the moment.
You've seen all these protests. Do you think they're actually going to lead somewhere? Because the impression I sort of get is that they're building to something.
Yeah, well, I think they've already led somewhere. I mean, for the first time, many young people, it's their first demonstration they've ever participated in, their first protest. In the United States, it's the first time I've been to hundreds of demonstrations and protests. It's the first time in the United States where there's a nationwide class-based protest against the against economic inequality. That's a new thing for the United States of America in my lifetime. So there have already been those successes. I agree that it seems like it's building something, and over the course of 2 months, there are now over 1,300 occupied cities, towns, and hamlets around the world with one united message that things are not right the way they are, and there needs to be a radical restructuring.
Traditionally, music has played a huge part of many protest movements. Looking at the charts and popular music these days, there doesn't seem to be that political element. You think back 30 years and there was the Clash over here and the Specials, sure, and all that sort of thing.
Sure.
And here, we haven't really had anything since Rage Against the Machine.
Mm. Well, this is not a movement that's waiting for a Rihanna anthem. You know what I mean? Like, this movement is doing very well on its own, thank you, without that. But I believe it is true that all successful progressive, nothing against Rihanna, I mean, she's fine, I'm not singling her out, but it doesn't need a pop star to step forward into the breach and pronounce their solidarity with a million-dollar video to accompany it. I'm not that familiar with successful progressive social movements here, but in the United States, you can't have a successful progressive social movement for justice that doesn't have a great soundtrack. Now, that doesn't mean it needs a great anthem. That just means there needs to be a culture of music that is part of what puts wind in the sails of a movement. This movement already has that. I mean, it's in this age of you know, tweeting and Facebook, it's a more democratized culture. I played at Occupy Wall Street. Before I played, two musicians played who were living in Occupy Wall Street. After I played, some other musicians played. So I was the one that maybe got written about in Rolling Stone, but I was 20% of the musical action that was going on that day, and that seems to be a healthy thing.
You're an incredibly well-known figure, but we haven't seen with the Occupy movement yet. You know, where's Bono? Where's Bob Geldof? Why do you think that that people like that haven't joined the cause?
The short answer would be that I don't think it matters. Perhaps the disappointing follow-up answer to that would be, I don't really care. it's not because of them, but because it's not a. I wouldn't ghettoize music. Let me make this very, very clear. I wouldn't ghettoize music in that way. I'm not worried about where are the other musicians in this. I don't look at myself. I look at myself. I'm worried about where are the people in this. And the people are doing fine. Musicians can be a part of it or not, and that's okay. But right now, the enormous growth and spread of this movement has been doing great without... all are welcome, you know? But it's not waiting for that. And that's a healthy thing, I think.
You see this having an impact next year on the elections in the U.S.?
That's interesting. How it moves the meter. I mean, I think one of the reasons, the causes for the Occupy movement, I think, are maybe threefold. One is the global economic decline, which blame is rightly laid at the malfeasance of the corporate sector, who torpedoed a global economy, causing so much economic misery for millions. Two is the Arab Spring. The lesson of that was, in order to change the world, all you have to do is walk out your front door and change the world. And then third, and why I believe it caught fire in the United States, was a disillusionment with Barack Obama and a realization that he's not going to be the magic prince that's going to wave a wand and make set everything right. We're on our own.
Did you get any sort of impression from the people you've met all over America? Are these the people who were knocking on doors for Obama?
Some of them were certainly those that were intoxicated by the hope that he presented. And he was, and while I was not... I was always very skeptical. It's true that he looks like it different than any other. He looks different than any other American president. He sounded different than any other American president. And so there was a hope that he would act different than another American president. And that hope did not come true.
Yeah. You mentioned that you were skeptical. Where do you personally sit in regard to mainstream politics? Because you sing about revolutionary change and so on. Is there any? Can we work within the mainstream political framework, or do we need a more revolutionary sort of thing?
For 2 years, I worked as the scheduling secretary for United States Senator Alan Cranston, Democratic senator from California. He's very, very progressive. He's to the left of Obama in a lot of things. And he was a nice guy. God rest his soul. He passed away about 10 years ago. 90% of the time I spent with him, he was on the phone asking rich guys for money. That's what it's about at the end of the day. You can want there to be gay marriage, and you can want, to save the whales and all that. But when it comes down to it, you are beholden to capital if you're going to be president of the United States. The end.
One of the things we hear over a lot when we get, mocking Fox News most of the time is the idea that the right is using this class warfare element. Is that necessarily a bad thing? Should we basically throw it back in their face and say, yes, it is a class war and you're on the wrong side?
Well, there's been a ferocious class war fought for decades, but it's only been fought by one side. It's been fought, the dismantlement of unions, the growing gulf between rich and poor, that's class warfare. The dismantling of people's ability to have control over how they live and how they work, and as the middle class gets pushed in the lower class gets pushed homeless. That's class warfare. That's what it is. Now, you've got 2,000 street corners, you've got some tents propping up, they're like, oh, boo-hoo, they found us out, they're protesting, wah, please. They're lucky we don't line them up against the wall. They're like, they should be counting their blessings.
I guess one of the challenges with challenging capitalism as it has manifested itself over the recent decades is that, in a sense, people still have to operate within the capitalist system. It's like one of the lazy criticisms of protesters over here has been, oh, look, they're going to Starbucks and stuff like that. How can people who, people like me, feel like they need to change? On the other hand, how can we do that in a way which doesn't feel hypocritical?
Okay. Well, there's on this new Night Watchman record that is called Worldwide Rebel Songs, there was the first song for it was the title track. The people that make, this is a story that's going to answer you, the people that make the low-end Gibson, Fender, and Ibanez guitars used to make them in a factory in Seoul, Korea. The workers in that factory formed a union. Because they formed a union, they were all fired, and the factory was moved to China, where there wouldn't be labor problems. Those Korean workers came to the United States looking for help. I offered to play a benefit show for them, but the day before the benefit show, the earthquake in Haiti happened, right? So these Korean workers would travel 6,000 miles, were in desperate need of financial help for their wives and their children, their strike fund, voted to donate 100% of the proceeds from their benefit show to the Haiti relief effort. It was such a selfless act of international solidarity. I wrote the song, Worldwide Rebel Songs, that they played it that night, because it's a reflection of and a window into the kind of world that I'd like to live in, the kind of world I'd like my children to inherit, and the kind of world that I fight for in my music. It's a little bit of that world that I see in all of these Occupy movements, where grassroots democracy, where cooperation, where sharing of abilities is what makes the thing run. They're creating a little bit of the world that they'd like to see on each of these street corners.
So is it a case of changing the people as well as changing the institutions?
Well, I mean, in part, the people have been changed because they used to have more money than they do now, and now they're pissed because they don't have jobs and homes anymore. So they've been changed in that way, but that is the, you know, that's the thread. You start pulling that thread and the whole sweater unravels. People now, for the first time, and Mike, I know here it's a little bit more class conscious, but the first time it is part of the, on the front page of New York Times every day, there's discussion about, do the rich control too much? And that's unheard of. You know, so the if nothing else, the dialogue has already changed dramatically. And as we do head into this election year, I'm certain we'll have repercussions.
Your new album, World Wide Rebel Songs, is all about sort of, you know, it makes you feel, yes, I want to do something. I want to, you know, get involved in that sort of thing. Do you think it's going to? Do you think the people who listen will feel fired up, or how, or is there going to be a certain percentage who just appreciate it as music? Because I can't separate music from politics.
I think that may have been more true with Rage Against the Machine, where there was a like such a powerful, aggressive component to it that you could love Rage Against the Machine and not be into. There are many Rage Against the Machine fans that are, you know, to the right of center, but they like to rock, and that's cool. That's all good. With this, I think there's less of that. I think that if you sort of know what I'm about and you listen to these records, it is in a way preaching to the converted, or at best the neutral. But frankly, the converted and the neutral need a kick in the ass too. You know, there's nothing wrong with that.
Where are you going to be heading next? What's
to this TV show tonight? Okay. My day's now. I got to go play a TV show tonight with Steve Earle. That's where I'm headed next, and then. Couple more days. I'm on tour with Rise Against here, you know, and that's what's been going on. Two more days of that, and then home for a while to begin my busy life back there.
And one final kind of joke question would be, would you like to see Rage be number one again for
our I wouldn't, you know what, let's not, that was a perfect moment right there. That was a perfect storm of sort of circumstance and the people's will. But I will thank all of your people who are listening to this or reading this that participate in that, because on the one hand it's a fun and flippant way to, you know, give the finger to Simon Cowell and the X Factor and commercial music being jammed down our throats, and on the other hand it's a microcosm in that people acting together in solidarity can do very unexpected things. For every Goliath there's a David, you know, and for the X Factor the David was a Facebook campaign and a 17-year-old Rage Against the Machine song. There are other Goliaths out there, and they have their Davids too.
I'll hate myself if I don't answer this. I heard rumors on the internet of obviously I'm assuming they're true, of new Rage Against the Machine material at some point.
Oh, yeah, a 10 disc album is coming out for Christmas this year. There's your scoop. It's 100 new songs coming out for Christmas this year. And they're all going to be number one.
We'll leave it there and let you get some tea. Tom Morello, Raging S Machine, Night Watchman, thank you so much for your time. It's been an honor. Thank you
very much. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
A new phrase entered the lexicon this week as everyone agreed that a Phobos grunt is the sort of noise you make when your rocket didn't make it into space and is instead hovering about aimlessly somewhere above the Earth. It's sort of this sort of noise. But why did the mission go wrong? And what were they trying to do in the first place? Cash Farouk has been speaking to astrobiologist Lewis Dartnell. Here's Cash with more.
Firstly, can you explain what Phobos grunt is?
Yeah, Phobos grunt is a Russian mission to Mars, but it's not designed to enter Martian orbit or land on the Martian surface like recent NASA probes have done. The Phobos grunt mission is a mission to one of the moons of Mars, to Phobos. And actually, grunt is Russian for soil. So this mission is designed to go to the largest moon of Mars, land a probe on its surface to scoop up some of that moon soil and then launch it all the way back to the Earth. So it's known as a sample return mission.
Apart from that part of the mission, there's also an experiment on it that you're quite interested in.
Yeah, my personal interest in Phobos grunt, I mean, the mission itself is very, very exciting, if it's successful, and we'll come back to that. But if this mission is successful, it will be the first time we've ever returned samples from a planetary body other than the moon. We've had some asteroid samples, and we've analysed things like comets in situ, but this will be the first time we'll be bringing back a sample of the surface of a body like this moon of Mars. But my personal interest in Phobos Grunt is that it's got a very small biological experiment strapped on onto the probe, and this is called the life capsule. And inside the life capsule, they've got 10 different organisms. So there's some tardigrades, which are tiny little microscopic animals that look almost like bears. They're called water bears, and they look almost cute under a microscope. And these tardigrades are known to being incredibly robust. They're very good survivors against a whole load of different environmental hazards, like being dried out and exposed to a vacuum and exposed to radiation. And there's also a lot of bacterial species as well. So things like Deinococcus radiodurans, which is a very, very radiation-resistant bacterium that I've been working on in the lab, as well as methanogen organisms, so cells that released methane as they grow. And all of these organisms are interesting for different reasons. And the idea of this experiment, of the life capsule, is to basically hitchhike on Phobos Grunt all the way through interplanetary space from Earth to Mars, and then all the way back again. So it'll be about a 3-year round trip. And to see what of these organisms are able to survive that journey in outer space, and importantly, beyond the magnetic field of the Earth. So they'll receive no protection whatsoever from the cosmic radiation. And the idea is this is going to be a very good test of the feasibility that life can be transferred naturally between planets inside meteorites, where again you'd have very minimal shielding from cosmic radiation. So that's a very kind of daring but deceptively simple experiment, that they're simply seeing which of these passengers survive the journey if it makes it back to Earth after that return mission.
Can you go into the reasons why this particular spacecraft is in the news at the moment?
It's really very frustrating. The spacecraft was launched successfully from Baikonur launch facility on Tuesday, and it successfully attained low Earth orbit. So the launch was successful. But what should have happened is that within a few hours of reaching low Earth orbit, the probe's own rocket booster should have fired. So it leaves Earth orbit and sends it on its course towards Mars and Phobos. And that hasn't happened. The probe, for whatever reason, has been stranded in low Earth orbit. And the scientists have been struggling now to regain reliable contact with this probe, try to work out what went wrong in the first place, and find a solution to this. It might be a problem with the software code, it might be a hardware problem, but something's prevented that rocket from firing. And the frustrating thing for the scientists and for the world watching this at the moment is that it's very much a race against time, that the probe is steadily decaying in its orbit. Although it's in low Earth orbit, there's still a very tenuous amount of atmosphere up there, and the probe is kind of plowing through this very thin atmosphere and gradually being slowed down and decaying, and its orbit is spiraling in closer and closer. And so the risk is if they don't make contact soon enough and work out what the problem is and lift it to higher orbit, it's going to fall out of the sky. This thing will fall as a shooting star. If you bear in mind that Phobos Grunt is an incredibly large mission, it's a 13-ton probe, and the Cassini probe, which is a multi-billion-dollar probe that has been launched and is still exploring Saturn at the moment. This probe is about 10 tons in total. Phobos Grunt is even more massive than that, and it's about to fall out of the skies on top of our heads. And most of this mass, about 10 tons of that, is the fuel that's required to take it all the way to Mars and then launch it back to the Earth. And this is quite toxic fuel. It's hydrazine and oxidizes. And most of this will vaporize and burn up high in the atmosphere. But there is a chance that some of this toxic fuel may make it to the surface and be spread over a wide area.
So, I saw one news agency describing it as the most toxic satellite ever. There is a small risk. There is a risk, but it's small.
The risk is greater than zero. It's non-negligible. And yes, there's a lot of toxic stuff on the satellite. But I say most of it, the vast majority, will burn up high. And it's not like there's going to be concentrated fuel canister, this toxic stuff landing intact on the surface somewhere. It's going to be spread out, and its effects are going to be spread over a wide area and therefore essentially diluted. And bearing in mind, there's more chance it will land in the ocean and away from populated urban areas than it will do falling over a town.
At the moment, I guess there's no way of knowing where it would crash. We just don't know at the moment.
No, exactly. It would be an uncontrolled re-entry. So we know what its orbital tract is, but we don't know exactly where on that tract it would deorbit and fall to the Earth. The latest news, though, is that this probe has been boosted to a slightly higher orbit. Not quite sure why, but they originally thought they had perhaps a fortnight to sort it out, and it's looking like early January would be the re-entry date now.
I thought there was something to do with the batteries. If once they run out, you won't be able to communicate with it. Is that correct?
Yes, the two concerns was that if this probe hasn't reorientated and pointed its solar panels towards the sun, the shorter time frame, its batteries would run out of juice before it deorbited. And once its batteries have run out, you have no chance of reestablishing contact. The probe is essentially dead by that point. And it seems, though, that the probe has, in fact, it's kind of entered into kind of an emergency safe mode, and it has got itself pointing correctly towards the sun. So there's not that concern now. But until the scientists can successfully fire that booster and get it out of low Earth orbit, there is still a distinct risk of it coming down out of orbit in an uncontrolled manner.
Yeah, I've actually read things about amateur astronomers sort of helping out and checking that it's not tumbling, seems to be on a proper orbit.
Yeah, I saw on Twitter this morning, actually, if you want to follow the lead scientist on the LIFE capsule on this biological experiment, is Dr. David Warmflash, and he tweets as Cosmic Evolution. So do keep up to date with his news updates and what's been happening with this probe. But I saw this morning on Twitter that the International Space Station, they've beamed up timings and directions when they ought to possibly see this probe in its orbit. So there might be some interesting photos from that coming out.
I read an article that you wrote recently about this not being the first failed Russian mission to Mars.
Yeah, there's been a string of bad luck, not especially with the Russians. It just underlines the fact that space exploration is very, very difficult. There's thousands of lines of computer code and software controlling the probes and their crew stages and all the kind of mechanical components and pumps and electronics that have all got to work. And if any one of those thousands of different components fails, it can ruin it. It can compromise the entire mission. So space is a very unforgiving place. And the Americans and the European Space Agency and Russia has always found Mars missions to be particularly difficult because you're going much further away than low Earth orbit or the moon. There's far fewer things you can do to rescue a mission if it starts getting into trouble. But the point I was making in this Huffington Post blog is that, I suppose, as Kennedy said himself, we do these things not because they're easy, but because they're difficult, because we learn an awful amount in the process of solving these difficult challenges. And obviously all of the science we get back when we've gone to the moon or we've gone to the Mars and we've explored it and analysed it and sent back the results, we've learned something about these other worlds and therefore also about the Earth as well. I don't know. The chances are looking slim. I think there's reason to be pessimistic about this mission, which, as I said earlier, is very frustrating because it did promise so much interesting stuff. But it's just the next mission. And NASA's launching its own rover to Mars called Mars Science Laboratory, and that will be launched at the end of this month, end of November. And then hopefully by about 2018, the European Space Agency, ESA, will be launching its own Mars mission called ExoMars, specifically to look for signs of life, and this is something I'm involved in myself. So the future's still bright. There's still a lot of things to be looking forward to, even if this mission doesn't quite make its goal.
Okay, on that optimistic note, I think this is a good place to end. Thank you very much, Lewis.
Cheers, Cash.
In order to actually resume the mission, the problem will need to be fixed by early December. After this date, due to the orbit of Mars relative to the Earth, the spacecraft would be unable to get to its destination, even if the Russian Space Agency did manage to fix it. Since I recorded this interview with Lewis, the Russian Space Agency have also made the following statement regarding the crash risk. There is no doubt that the spacecraft will explode upon re-entry as it approaches the denser layers of the atmosphere. Let's hope so. This is Cash Farouk for The Pod Delusion.
Now, if you enjoy the unrelenting cycle of death that is the natural world, then you'll no doubt have been watching the BBC's latest Attenborough-fronted nature documentary, Frozen Planet, which is all about the polar regions. The Telegraph kicked up a right fuss this week when it alleged that, when the series was being sold around the world, the BBC have taken out an episode about climate change, the implication being that it's too much of a hot topic for the Americans to handle. But is there any truth to this? To find out, Liz Luckendorf spoke to the series' principal academic advisor, polar scientist Dr. Mark Brandon, to get his take, and to find out a bit more about what went into making the series. Liz started by asking him, exactly what is the role of an academic advisor?
if you look at the polar regions from a broad context, there are so many stories about things that are going to happen, great science stories to follow and things like that. My role in it as a principal scientific advisor was to help the BBC see what the important things they really needed to get into their story to tell the story of the polar regions, which is what they're really interested in doing.
So do you have much of a say in what went into the programme? Do they film things first and then you advise on the science, or do you tell them where to go?
Obviously, as an Open University academic, I can't speak for the way the BBC put it together, but my understanding of this project is it's been so huge that it's taken a lot of development to sort out the story. So I've actually been involved in it since 2008, January actually, so a hell of a long time. From the very beginning, we were talking to the senior producers, Vanessa Berlowitz, who's an amazing producer, to suggest to her what the best things she really needed to include if you wanted to talk about the polar regions. For example, if you talk to your average person in the street, they don't realise that if you look at the Arctic, most of it is an ocean, and it's only covered with ice, only a couple of metres thick, and that ice is made of frozen seawater. But if you compare that with the Antarctic, where you've got ice on land, which is kilometres thick, then it makes a completely different situation for the physical environment, the weather systems you're getting, and the animals that can actually live there. So what they needed and what my help throughout the series has been is putting those sorts of context into what they're filming.
I was amazed by all the stuff in the ocean, and there's that, I don't know if you've seen it, but the massive underwater spider with half-meter long legs and stuff, which will probably give me nightmares because I don't like spiders.
I have to say, I'm not a diver, I'm a physical scientist. I'm actually a polar oceanographer, and I've worked, I mean, one of the reasons I think maybe I talk a bit of the BBC's language because I worked a lot on the boundaries between different disciplines. So as a polar oceanographer, I'm interested in climate physics and how the ice affects the ocean. But I've written journal articles with biologists, with chemists, and with glaciologists as well. So really quite a broad view. But I have to say, the biologists I've worked with that do diving, I'm filled with respect for, because I'm not sure what I would do if I came across one of those spiders underwater. I think if you stay with the series, you might not be surprised to see something like that again coming up.
I will steady myself for that. When we spoke to David Attenborough in August, he spoke about challenges in weaving the story out of what have been filmed. Do you have any idea of how this process works? Like, will artistic desire win over something that's science just for the narrative reasons?
My perception from where I've worked on this series is that's not the case, because the Natural History Unit, what they're actually interested in is telling the story of what's actually happening in nature. It's not a continuous sequence of events. And what I mean by that is one of the key images from the series on the BBC website is the orca whales attacking the seal. And, you know, the BBC have said that was filmed, the composite that was used in the Frozen Planet episode. It was actually from more than 20 individual hunts that they put together that story.
Mm.
But the fundamental story of how the whales work together, how they create this wave, how they knock the seal off, that is something which happens every day when the seals are feeding. So that's the only manipulation that goes on. And with an organisation like the Natural History Unit, they only get their reputation by telling the truth.
I guess, I don't know if you would know about the commercial pressures, but is there anything that you need to feature because people like them? Like James gave the example, are penguins really boring, but everyone likes to see them?
Do you know, I've thought that myself, but again, this is going to sound a bit lame, but I don't think that's the case. The amount of people that want to see anything polar, I mean, some of the animals that will come up in future episodes of the series haven't actually been seen, to my knowledge, in sort of primetime audience. They're not filming them because they're new. They're filming them because they tell us something really important about the environment and the animals. But if you take, for example, one of the clips that was a highlight from an earlier episode with the penguins stealing stones. I don't know if you remember that one. So the penguins stealing stones, the Adélie penguin, that's just what they do. It wasn't one dodgy penguin. All penguins steal from each other. And if you go to the Antarctic on a tour ship, you're actually told by the guides that you can't even pick up those little pebbles and put them in your pocket. And the tourists will turn around and say, well, why can't I pick a stone up? But when you see that series and how the penguins use those pebbles to make their nest, suddenly it becomes clear. So I don't think it's commercial pressure. I think that they're just such compelling stories. The BBC want to tell them.
I was tweeting along while I was watching the series. I kept on calling them thieving bastard penguins.
Yeah. Well, you know, as a physical scientist, I'm not a fan of penguins. I think they're very cute. I think they're very nice. But I think when you've been bitten by one, you have a different view.
Well, the big controversy to hit Twitter this week was the Telegraph reporting that episode 7, which is going to be the climate change episode, was taken out of the international series. There's been some slight changes of why this was now, but what do you make of this attention to the climate change episode?
Well, the first time it was raised, to my knowledge, that about how Frozen Planet was addressing climate change was actually in the House of Lords in May of this year, when Sir David Attenborough was in a parliamentary committee. And he was asked by a baroness, you know, we've heard you're going to make some controversial statements. And his answer was along the lines of, well, you know, the only controversy is how much of it is to do with anthropogenic contribution. All we do in Frozen Planet is talk about the facts of climate change, which are scientifically established. That's all we do in the episode. If you were to imagine an episode where people just talked about, you know, humans are doing this, humans are doing that, that wouldn't fit in with the rest of the story. What would make perfect sense if you're telling the story of the polar regions is to talk about how they're changing in the context of the animals and the environments that you've shown through the last, the previous 6 hours of episodes. So from that point of view, I find it interesting that it's kind of been highlighted. How the BBC sell it abroad is a BBC issue. I think that the statement they released where they said it's up to, you know, American broadcasters will be taking elements of those programs and including them in theirs anyway, I think that's a really good way of framing it. It's very easy to think that the BBC would take a program like Frozen Planet and sell it. But if you think of the previous series, which was Planet Earth, I don't know if you remember that one.
Mm-hmm.
With Planet Earth, for example, the narrator in Britain was David Attenborough. In the States, it was Sigourney Weaver. So, you know, they change it for their viewing. The underlying fact is the Natural History Unit team recognised that you can't tell the story of the polar regions without talking about change. And if you embed change into every single episode of the series, it's very easy to confuse seasonal cycle, the very large seasonal changes that are happening in the polar regions, with what are actually happening in longer term changes which are going on with climate change, with Arctic and Antarctic warming. And that confusion is deliberately made by many people who talk about who speak against anthropogenic global warming. So it makes sense to tell it as a separate episode.
As an academic advisor, are you mostly focused on the science of what you were speaking before about the seasonal aspects of it, or are you allowed to be activist in the sense that you're saying we should have a climate change episode or we should include things like that?
I'm a research scientist and I write academic textbooks for the OU, so personally I'm not an activist, but my interest is in telling the science and the science story. So everyone, there was widespread general agreement years ago that if you're going to talk about the polar regions, it would be frankly laughable to not talk about, you know, things like glacier retreat that's happened on ice shelf collapse, sea ice retreating in the Arctic. It wouldn't make sense. There will be people who will interpret scientific facts as activism, but they're just facts, you know. If you measure that, you know, a glacier has retreated by so many kilometers in so many decades, that's a fact. You might argue about the context, the wider scale things and stuff like that, but not the fact of it actually happening. And so, yeah, that's what makes sense. I don't believe that Frozen Planet is an activism program. I think it's a program about the polar regions.
I'm sorry we went a bit longer than planned, but this is absolutely fascinating. Thank you very, very much for agreeing to this interview.
It's been a delight to talk to you. Don't miss the next few episodes of Frozen Planet to see what people are really assuming is in the program. It's not necessarily what they think, but it's scientific facts.
You can hear a longer version of this interview, which discusses some of the animals featured in the series and more about the science, on our website at poddelusion.co.uk. The microprocessor is 40 years old this week, or 1,048,576 years old in Moore's years. And it's fair to say that they're quite important. After all, without them you wouldn't be hearing my voice right now. So yes, you should be thankful for the microprocessor. But how do they pack so many transistors onto a chip? And how much smaller can they go? Sean Ellis has been finding out.
This week marks the 40th anniversary of the first commercial microprocessor. Things have moved on a lot in the last four decades, and since I work for UK chip designer Arm, I tracked down Greg Yerrick, who's one of Arm's leading researchers on the physical side of things, based in Texas. Hello, Greg.
Hi, John. I'm in an R&D group that focuses on future chip design issues. To make our chips our designs as effective for our customers as possible, we need to understand the complexities of the manufacturing process, and that's why I'm ARM.
Can you just give us a quick overview of how silicon chips are actually made?
Sure. A chip is a substrate on which we make these small circuits, integrated circuits. And those are basically a collection of switches connected with wires. The transistors for the 40 years of microprocessors have been made from silicon. And crystalline silicon that behaves as something called a semiconductor, which is to say it either can allow electricity to conduct through it or not. In the early 20th century, people figured out how to modulate this behavior from conducting to not conducting with precise amounts of impurities that modulation could be manufactured into something called a transistor. That process, by the way, is called doping. We later found that we could dynamically change this behavior with voltages, and that actually led to the modern-day transistor, the primary element of logic in the computer chips. Why silicon? It's plentiful. More importantly to us, it oxidizes and forms silicon dioxide, a very nice insulator that we use to isolate regions on the computer chip. We actually don't make the chips chip by chip. We use a bigger substrate we call a wafer, which today is 300 millimeters in diameter. It's about a millimeter thick, and we make multiple copies of chips on these wafers. We slice them up, and we have our chips.
Okay, so what's the processing steps that are required?
One of the fundamental steps is to define the patterns that make these transistors and these wires. It's called lithography, by the way. Its basic form is to coat the wafer with a light-sensitive material and then expose the wafer to light selectively. And we do that by inserting what we call a mask between the light and the wafer. The mask historically was simply a film of chrome on quartz, and we would cut the chrome away in the patterns where we intended to make patterns on the wafer. If light passed through the quartz, it would react with the sensitive material, and the material would actually just wash off before we coat the wafer with, a layer of aluminum. And we perform this lithography step, and we can expose the wafer with the light, and then we can etch away the aluminum where we've exposed on the wafer and leave it where it is underneath the photosensitive material, and that's how we produce the lines on the wafers. The etching system was more a 1970s era, where you literally did put the wafers into a chemical solution. Eventually, the industry went to a plasma chamber. Electric fields direct plasma ions perpendicular into the wafer and make very clean vertical edges of the patterns that we intend. The impurities that we dope the silicon with will either create a slight excess of electrons or a slight lack of electrons with respect to the normal silicon. That used to be simply heating the wafer up when something was stuck to the wafer that had the right material properties. Nowadays, we actually fire the impurity atoms into the wafer so that we can precisely arrange the depth and areas where these dopant atoms will be. So that's allowed us to scale these 40 years into some really, really small feature sizes.
You talk about the scaling there. What are we talking about these days?
The first microprocessor was about 10 microns in feature size, and we used to conveniently compare that to the size of a hair. Today, if you look at the products that you can buy today, those features are 28 nanometers, so 10,000 nanometers. Now we're at 28 nanometers 40 years later.
28 nanometers sounds really small. How does that compare to, say, a silicon atom itself?
Well, a silicon atom or atoms in general are typically a tenth or a couple tenths of a nanometer.
Right, so you're looking at features that are only a few hundred atoms across.
Other examples are DNA strands are about 2 nanometers in diameter. Viruses are typically 100 or 200 nanometers, so we're already smaller than viruses in the features that we print.
It must be really difficult to print something that small, especially when you're doing several steps and it's all got to line up. I mean, do you print the whole surface of the wafer at once?
No. In fact, that is another key piece of the evolution of the printing of the chips and making these feature sizes so small. 40 years ago, we did expose the entire wafer. All 2 inches of that wafer were exposed at once. And in fact, the mask was pressed onto the wafer. It was called contact printing. The wavelength of light that we started with was blue light, which is around 400 nanometers. Today, we've shrunk that wavelength to 193 nanometers, but as you'll note, that's actually not shrunk very much compared to the feature sizes. We're actually, incredibly enough, printing these features at 28 nanometers that are much smaller than the wavelength of light. To do that, there have been many, many fundamental engineering triumphs along the way, one of which was to realize that we'll expose pieces of the wafer at a time. And so we went from what was called contact printing to these machines that were called steppers, printing 1 or 2 centimeters at a time. Another advancement that came along was light is focused so that it's 4 times smaller on the wafer than when it goes through the mask. Actually, if we just use a slit of light and make a precise movement of that slit across the mask in concert with the wafer moving, we do that fast enough where we can do about 80 of these 12-inch wafers per hour in a factory.
And get everything lined up to within 20 nanometers.
Yes, you're only given approximately 1 second to do this exposure. And in that 1 second, the stepper is making multiple optical measurements to get that to that type of precision, do the exposure, and physically move to the next spot. It's a quite incredibly impressive technology, and you pay approximately $20 million for the privilege of having one of these really incredible tools in your factory. That's quite an investment. In fact, the total investment of the next generation factories is $5 to $10 billion.
So that's where we are now. What's coming up in the next 10 years?
So in the next 10 years, we've got a very interesting period in the industry. The occasion of our conversation is the 40-year anniversary of the microprocessor, it turns out. And through that entire 40-year period, we've basically used the same transistor called a MOSFET. The next node will switch to a slightly different formulation of the transistor called a FinFET. It's actually a fin that sticks out of the wafer, and that allows us to scale these transistors. It's expected that we'll do this large wholesale switch to something called extreme ultraviolet lithography, using a wavelength of light that's 13 nanometers. We'll have to switch from a lens-based method to a mirror-based method. And the mirrors themselves to reflect 13 nanometer light are really complicated atomic layer interference patterns called Bragg reflectors. Each mirror is going to be incredibly expensive, and the number of mirrors required to focus the light correctly will be large. In the material side of things, we used a handful of materials for the dopants. In the future, we're really going to open up the periodic table. We may have to switch from silicon. That'll be a big change. Other things that are being proposed, one of which would be a sheet of carbon called graphene, or a tube of carbon called a carbon nanotube. So there's a lot of things in this 10 to 20 year window that will make it quite interesting to be in the industry.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for talking with me today.
My pleasure.
So for the last 40 years, chips have got smaller, faster, and more capable. Despite the challenges of new processes and new materials, it seems like we haven't seen the last of this progress yet. This is Sean Ellis with Greg Yarrick from Arm for the Pod Delusion.
Now, does the left or the right lie the most? In this next report, Stephen Sumter explains why, in his opinion, conservatives seem to lie the most. Or maybe he doesn't explain that. Maybe I lied to you. You'll just have to listen to find out. Here's Stephen.
I think it is fair to say that people of all worldviews seem to mislead the public to benefit their message, but I have noticed a trend of obvious lies coming from those of a right-wing persuasion. Perhaps it isn't all lies. Sometimes a politician or a journalist will publish something that is obviously untrue when I look at it, but maybe they honestly didn't know that. More often, though, I think that the lies are either deliberately made up to deceive the public, or are made up by someone else and then repeated with no effort made to check the truth, because the lie fits the message that they want to spread. I particularly notice that right-wing newspapers across the board are happy to lie or mislead people. Smear campaigns, trashing of people's lives, lies about statistics, facts, figures, and all sorts of other things are common. In the USA, right-wing television, such as Fox News, more blatantly misleads too, but not so much in the UK because of our tighter regulation of TV. Conservative politicians are happy to repeat untruths in and out of Parliament, on television, and in interviews. For example, David Cameron is still repeating statistics about job creation during the lifetime of this government, which are completely false. Maria Miller has repeated statistics on television about sickness and disability benefits which were just not true. There are many more examples. Some of the lies go even further. In 2009, the then Home Secretary Alan Johnson sacked Professor David Nutt, head of the Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs, because he criticised the reclassification of cannabis and made other statements about drugs which did not support the government's chosen drug policy. Rather than listen to the facts, politicians sacked the scientists in favour of someone who would tell the lies that they wanted. More recently, in Texas, Governor Rick Perry has gone as far as to remove all mentions of climate change and sea level rises from a major environmental study. It wasn't just interpretation of results that he had removed, it was things like actual measurements of sea level rises that didn't agree with his politics. He is seemingly prepared to lie to his state and to himself to push his policies on everyone, even at risk of massive environmental disaster in his own state. However, it is not only conservatives and right-wing people that give incorrect information. Those of a left-wing persuasion are not immune from spreading misleading information either. For example, it seems to be a common statement among those fighting for disability rights and against welfare cuts that up to 70% of ATOS decisions are overturned on appeal. However, that is highly misleading. In fact, it is only between 40 and 70% of decisions declaring the patient fit to work that are overturned, and only 66% of decisions declare the patient fit to work, and only 32% of those found fit for work actually appealed. In actual fact, only 8.4% of those found fit for work in England have actually won an appeal. We can argue that 14.8% would have won their appeal had they received legal representation, and we can also argue that many people who could have appealed did not for various reasons, including exhaustion from the process or being too ill to continue or fear of what could happen. Now, 8.4% up to 14.8% of decisions incorrectly declaring someone fit for work is still an obscene number, but it is not 70%. I can see how the 70% figure gets used, though. 70% is an attention-grabbing number that makes a great headline. Since it is an actual real statistic, it can be used without understanding exactly where it came from. Most people will not work through the numbers and perhaps not even realise that it is misleading. Perhaps even the original person to use that statistic did not know that. It only takes one person to use it for many other people to copy it and perhaps leave out the relevant information that explains the number. One thing that is different between conservatives and most other people is that most people will correct their statements when given evidence that shows how and why they are wrong. It seems that conservatives are not so easily put right. In fact, conservatives are more likely to believe the lie when told it is not true. In 2008, political scientists Brendan Nyhan and Jason Reifler found that there is a backlash effect when conservatives are proven wrong, leading to a stronger belief in false statements. Although this was an American study, the effect is observable in political debates here in the UK, particularly when it comes to things that people get very worked up about, like abortion, immigration, and the European Union. You only have to observe the arguments of people like MP Philip Davis or MEP Roger Helmer to see the effect in action. When Justice Secretary Ken Clark exposed a claim by Home Secretary Theresa May as lies, in fact he said the claim was laughable and childlike, it was not Theresa May that was called to account by the Prime Minister, but Ken Clark. It seems that when a false and ludicrous example is used to back up Tory rhetoric, not even another Tory minister is allowed to dispute it. I think, then, that many of the statements that are called out as lies might actually be believed to be true by people saying them. While many will retract or correct their statements if necessary, that does not help when incorrect information has already been used in a headline or repeated far and wide. In fact, some people deliberately make incorrect statements knowing that they can get away with it by retracting or correcting later. The Daily Mail has got this down to a fine art, and several recent articles of theirs about the motability scheme have actually provided both true and lie in the same article. They print the actual facts and figures somewhere deep within the article, but the majority of the text talks about the subject in an entirely false way. Although lies happen across the political spectrum, I think by far the biggest problem comes from cabinet ministers in our current government, government departments and right-wing newspapers. Most of the liars are never called to account by any authorities, especially not the Press Complaints Commission. Some of the problems have been noticed, however. In July, Dame Anne Begg, MP, wrote to Employment Minister Chris Grayling with serious concerns about the way that the Department of Work and Pensions has been releasing statistics and the way that those statistics have been represented in the newspapers. Recently, the new Shadow Minister for Disabled People, Anne Maguire, has accused the government of talking up benefit fraud. What, then, is the solution to all this? If you are writing something or passing on information, please check your facts, include relevant qualifiers for your data, and don't lie by omission. For politicians and government ministers, we obviously need some authority or watchdog to actually take responsibility for correcting them and forcing them to retract their statements. As for newspapers, clearly the Press Complaints Commission is utterly useless. We need to shut it down and replace it. Finally, it would be really nice if everyone would always present the evidence for what they say. This is Stephen Sumter for The Pod Delusion.
Now, is there any evidence for Jesus actually existing? This week, Salim Fadli has been speaking to Robert M. Price, who has been investigating. Here's Sal with more.
Robert M. Price is a professor of systematic theology. You probably already know him as a presenter of Point of Inquiry and also from his own Bible Geek podcasts. If you enjoy this show, I can pretty much guarantee that you'd love his work. His new book, The Christ Myth Theory and Its Problems, is intended to give us a more naturalistic and historically plausible framework in which to understand the origins of Christianity. I began by asking Dr. Price why non-religious people ought to be concerned with the origins of a text whose fundamental message we reject.
It's because, as Robert Ingersoll said long ago, that there are a lot of loud people who are using this text as a weapon to manipulate the rest of us, claiming that it is the infallible word of God, and those who don't kneel to it will wind up in hell. That's not to say the Bible is a bad book. It's no worse than the Iliad or the Odyssey, and it's just as fascinating, but it isn't the word of God, and you shouldn't have to think you must believe and do whatever it says. And it's our job as scholars and people who care about the public to make that clear.
Just what is the Christ myth theory, besides the obvious assertion that Jesus Christ was a literary or mythical character rather than a living, breathing, historical human being?
Well, it's not an ideological or anti-religious opinion. You can still be a Christian and believe in the Christ myth theory, though there are few who do, but it's just a plea for consistency. You have all sorts of ancient stories of miracle-working divine men, dying and rising gods. Why should this one be taken seriously when Attis, Osiris, Hercules, and the others are not?
Before I became familiar with your work, I would have assumed that Jesus was most probably an actual historical person whose achievements had been greatly exaggerated by followers. For example, in one of your podcast lectures, you gave an example of how the myth of Haile Selassie had been promoted by the Rastafarians, who claimed that he was a miracle worker. Could Jesus have been such a person?
Oh, indeed he could. I never argued that that's even implausible. It's just that with characters like Haile Selassie, Cyrus the Great, Caesar Augustus, around whom many of the same mythemes cluster, there is also solid secular, evidence connecting them in many ways, at many points, to world history. But in the case of Jesus, the only three such connections, those to Herod the Great, Caiaphas and Pontius Pilate, are all historically very problematical, and once you recognize they're spurious, there really is nothing to anchor Jesus in history. He may have been a historical figure, but if so, he has been so completely obscured by legend that we'll never know.
In your writing and lectures, you've highlighted a great deal of mythology which predates the Christian New Testament. There are stories, as you say, of magic men who perform miracles, heal the sick, and even cheat their own deaths. But there's no single character from literature or myth who does all of these things just like Jesus. Does this lack of a perfect parallel narrative provide a problem for the Christ myth theory?
actually not. The various elements of what some call the mythic hero archetype, there are about 20 of them. The life of Jesus includes more of those than Oedipus, the Buddha, Alexander, etc., etc. It's almost the perfect case of it, but you wouldn't expect every myth theme to be present with every figure. Nonetheless, having said that, Apollonius of Tyana, supposedly a contemporary of Jesus, in the very long life of Apollonius by Flavius Philostratus, the parallels are nearly complete. He doesn't die and rise, but they think he's dead, and then he appears to his grieving followers, demonstrates his survival, and then later ascends into heaven after exorcisms, teachings, healings, a miraculous birth. Apollonius is almost a complete parallel, though apparently not derivative from the Jesus story. They're all just in the same categories. The stories don't look enough like them for borrowing to be likely.
I suppose one of the best contemporary illustrations is Harry Potter and Star Wars being clearly examples of the same kind of genre, but maybe aren't derivative of one another.
That's right, or comic book superheroes. There are a few very basic plans to the characters and their abilities and their feats. There's the human hero like Batman, the all-powerful hero like Superman, and within that there are many, 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 many variations, all of them fresh and interesting, but all obviously in the same category, and all of them fictitious.
Your new book is called The Christ Myth Theory and Its Problems. Other than the fact that the world is full of literalist, Bible-believing fundamentalists, what are the main problems with the current Christ myth theory?
Well, I'm dealing one by one with the usual objections to it, such as that Paul mentions having met James, the brother of the Lord. Doesn't that mean Jesus was at least a near contemporary? And I show how that epithet probably means one of several other possibilities. Another one is that the Christ myth theory assumes that the epistles, the letters of Paul, and others are earlier than the Gospels, and the epistles do not know of a life of the historical Jesus. But I argue that the epistles are as late or later. Does that hurt the case for it? There's an analogy between the caliphate after Muhammad's death and the leadership of the Jerusalem church after Jesus. Does that analogy not mean that this is probably just as historical? And various other issues. Was there a pre-Christian Jesus cult, as many of the old Christ mythers thought, but seems less likely? I show actually you can make a very good case, better than the old timers did. So what I'm doing is to raise all the scholarly objections and to ask fairly, are these really Achilles' heels? And I think they're not, as honestly as I can treat them.
Any attempt to grapple with the Bible forces the reader to acknowledge that there's really more here than meets the eye, much more than tradition would like to acknowledge. I've often felt that there's probably no better antidote to fundamentalist Christianity than a serious reading of the Bible.
It's a matter of Socratic humility. The biblical critic doesn't open the Bible thinking that he knows all of it in advance because some church has told him. He brackets what it's supposed to mean and looks at all the puzzling evidence and finds that it's like shards standing out in a field of rubble. He starts to do archaeology and begins to disclose unguessed strata of the history of the Bible and its world. And you realize you've just got a learner's permit. You're just at the beginning of a fascinating journey of discovery. I think that's better and more inspiring than thinking that you've got the Bible wrapped up and in your back pocket.
I think adopting Dr. Price's approach makes us more honest and effective critics of religion and its harms. I'm reminded of all the debates I've had with Bible believers. I don't think I've ever managed to sway a single person, because the kind of arguments that appeal most strongly to me tend to have very little impact on people who've made huge emotional investments in dogma. However, I suspect that arguments grounded in biblical text might be more impactful. This is Salem Fadley for The Pod Delusion.
Finally this week, Tanis Pendergrass has been thinking about how to engage with the people who may have some rather silly beliefs. She thinks that rather than have a go at people who believe in psychics, we ought to be nice. It's a clever idea, but I think I can sense Tanisi's plan. If we're nice to them, we can gain their trust and get really close to them before shouting in their face. To tell us the rest of the plan, here's Tanis with more.
Further to last week's reports on guerrilla scepticism and talking to the dead, I thought it might be worth talking to Pod Delusion listeners about Project Barnum and how to use the resources it offers to talk to people with a different viewpoint. I first got involved with Project Barnum in September when Hayley Stevens, the founder, posted about a new project that she was working on. Project Barnum is an activism and educational resource on the web to protect consumers from those claiming psychic powers, those who are actually using techniques like hot reading and cold reading to deceive. You can read more about the aims of Project Barnum on the website, but this report isn't really about psychics. It's about the people who believe in their powers. I help run a Skeptics in the Pub group, and I'm fascinated by the people who believe in claims with very little to no evidence for their worth, efficacy, or existence. Unfortunately, I don't have an exciting story of conversion from believer to skeptic. I've never really believed in what James Randi, a magician and skeptic, calls woo-woo, but I've always been interested in those beliefs and the people who have them. In September, I started following Sally Morgan, who claims to be psychic, on Twitter, after author, broadcaster and scientist Simon Singh tweeted that she preemptively blocked him. Anyway, to cut a long story and several tweets short, it turned out she'd be performing at G Live, which is a large venue in Guildford where I happened to co-run my Skeptics in the Pub meeting. With the ideas and inspiration behind Project Barnum fresh in my mind, I plucked up the courage to go down to Guildford and speak to her fans. The real crux of what I want to speak to you about is reaching out to believers and taking the time to talk to them, finding out what they believe and why. Too often, some skeptics tend to spend their time talking to other skeptics, and they're often rude and disrespectful to believers on the other side of the argument. Even talking about sides, as I have just now, is divisive and creates a bad atmosphere. My intention in talking about this is to show that not all skeptics, as some believers think, are dismissive and haughty. I've seen far too much bullying from so-called skeptics, and I had to do something about it. So, step one, find out the information that you need. It's all very well believing that you're in the right when you think something is pseudoscientific or bunkum or just not true, but what does the person actually believe? Do they believe that psychics are able to predict the future or just relay messages from a spirit? If you're talking to someone about, for example, alternative medicine, then find out what claims they make instead of just dismissing things because you believe there's either no evidence or any studies on the subject are not robust or just badly done. But don't just plan your arguments to counter what someone says. Really listen to what they say and learn from their stance. You can even mirror your body language with someone to build rapport, remain calm and good-humoured throughout. This doesn't mean you can't put your point across, but be nice. Step 2. Chill out. Remember that people believe different things and they're just as entitled to their opinion as you are. You may feel that you're on the high ground by valiantly fighting for truth, reason and critical thinking, but if you go out intending to make yourself heard only and just to make a point, then you've missed it already. You've missed the point of skeptical outreach. Step 3. Tool up. When it comes to skeptical activism, there are many tools that you can use. Specifically, when it comes to talking to fans of psychics, there are absolutely loads of resources with more plan that you can use. There are posters, business cards, and there's even an audio trailer available on the Project Barnum website that you can use in your own podcast. Step 4. Don't go alone or in a big crowd. Going alone is not only a bit scary, however outgoing a person you are, but it's also potentially dangerous. Challenging someone's beliefs, however you do it, is likely to lead to at least a little bit of conflict. And given that you won't usually know the person before you do it, it's a good idea to go in a small group or a larger group split into cells. Large groups will be intimidating and more likely to lead to trouble, so keep it small. Step 5. The most important, don't intend to convert someone. You're not there to convert them into a skeptic like you. If that's your goal, then you're likely to go away disappointed and a little bit frustrated, and that's never a good place to be. Go to learn more about the kind of people skeptics actually care about. Vulnerable people who might be taken advantage of. After all, as professional skeptic DJ Grace says, skepticism is like a beautiful marriage of consumer protection and science education, and all for the public good. For more information on Project Barnum, go to projectbarnum.co.uk. This has been Tanis Pendergrass reporting for The Pod Delusion.
Project Barnum was created to provide information pertaining to the use of psychological tricks by self-titled mediums and psychics while on stage or in private readings. Project Barnum will also provide advice to those who think they have already been misled. Project Barnum. See them coming.
And that's it for this week's show. Do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can listen to a full version of our interviews with Mark Brandon from Frozen Planet and a longer cut of Sean's interview on microprocessors. Also on our website, you can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter and even find out how to get involved in the show yourself. I can't believe I've not mentioned this before, but the Pod Delusion also now goes out on Resonance FM in London at 11 a.m. on Sunday mornings. So if you're in the London area, tune in to 104.4 and have a listen. And now some awkward begging. If you enjoy the Pod Delusion and want to support what we do, then why not subscribe to donate £5 or £10 a month or make a one-off donation? It would really go a long way to helping us continue doing this sort of thing. You can find links to do so at poddelusion.co.uk. The Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Cash Farouk, Liz Lutkendorf, Sean Ellis, Stephen Sumter, Salim Fadley, Denise Pendergrass, and me, James O'Malley, with additional editing by Liz Lutkendorf. The sketch in a moment is by David Lovesey and Brian Too. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
And don't forget to tune in next week when the team at Bargain Hunt try to find more bargain basement reality shows to fill the daytime schedules. This is the BBC. Shortly, it will be time for CBeebies, and in light of the new unemployment figures for young people, we've decided to be realistic about children's expectations for the future. At 4 o'clock, we have the new adventures of Postman Pat, which we've renamed Pat. The same applies to Fireman Sam, or Sam. Fortunately, we've kept the name of popular show Underground Ernie, but changed the concept to be about a young man going underground to escape the bailiffs. At 5 o'clock, Blue Peter will be showing you how to make a career with some sticky-back plastic and a parent in a high-paid government job. But before that, Junior MasterChef, and this week the contestants are put to the test in the ultimate thrift cuisine challenge, a toast sandwich. All these shows are available to watch again on iPlayer, and will also probably be repeated between the hours of 9 to 5, Monday to Friday. After all, there'll be nothing better for people to do.